Rail passengers could see their ticket prices rise by 4.8% next year, which is going to be the largest rise in a decade. This is despite calls from many quarters for fares to be frozen. Joining me now on the line, Bruce Williamson, who is from Rail Future, who campaigned for improvements to the passenger and freight rail network. Hello, Bruce.
Hi.
It does seem like quite a hike, but if the railways are going to be improved, as you have campaigned for, surely they need an influx of money like this.
Well, they do, but this is the argument that's been put forward year after year after year. And, you know, for many passengers, they don't see this improvement. And what's particularly unfair is the way that they jack the prices up effectively ahead of inflation. So, as you may be aware, there are two measures of inflation. There's the lower CPI measure, which is usually lower, and that's just 2%. And then there's the higher RPI figure, which has come out at 3.8%, nearly double. Now, all economists and the government themselves say, no, we prefer CPI, it's a much more accurate measure, and so on. But rail fares are jacked up by RPI. So effectively, it's actually racing way ahead of inflation. And that's, you know, it's firstly, it's unfair, and secondly, it's not sustainable.
Well, we could argue about which inflation measure is more accurate, but I think that the lower one doesn't really reflect what people's experience is in week to week, because I don't think it covers petrol, does it?
I believe it does. I mean, like I say, it's widely regarded as a more accurate measure, and the government themselves say this is the one we prefer. So they use it for everything else. You know, they use it for wage negotiations and benefits and pensions and everything, except rail fares. You know, when it's more than double that, and not only that, in many years in the past, they've jacked it up not just by RPI, but RPI plus one.
Yeah.
Now, you know, you have to contrast that as well with the way that they're treating motorists, because motorists have had their fuel duty frozen for 10 years now. So the government is just not playing fair with the rail passengers. If you can afford to freeze fuel duty for motorists, surely you can afford to freeze rail fares as well. That's only fair, isn't it?
Well, not really, because the duty on fuel is enormous, whereas the duty on the railways is relatively small compared to the amount of money that the government takes per litre in petrol and diesel.
Yeah, but that goes towards paying for things like roads, and there's all sorts of economic arguments that say that actually, you know, I know very popularly it's the war on the motorist being ripped off, it's all taxes and so on. But when there's a much bigger picture to this, and there's loads and loads of counter-arguments, which we haven't got time for now. But, you know, I think, what can I say? You know, where's the fairness here? Where's the sanity? Because I think we might have reached the stage where actually putting up rail fares doesn't work anymore. We're currently in a situation where more and more people are sort of working from home. We've had COVID and all that. And things are never going to quite be the same again. And when people have learned that they don't necessarily need to go into work, they're going to do it less and less. And if the price keeps going up, that will deter passengers to the point where the number of passengers goes down and the fare revenue overall goes down. And the government ends up losing money because they put the fares up too much.
Of course, the last year has been particularly difficult for public transport in general, because their three revenue streams have been cut to almost nothing. The fares, of course, is an obvious one. Very few people have been travelling on the railways compared to normal. And then they have the advertising revenue, which has also been decimated because there aren't enough passengers, or as many as there were, then there aren't any eyes on adverts. So people have been reluctant to spend on advertising on trains, but also on top of that, the retail income from shops on railways properties, that's also been decimated as well. So there is a massive funding gap here, and either we have fewer trains or we have higher prices. I mean, how could it be otherwise?
Well, I think we have to treat the railways in this regard as same as any other industry, because pretty much every industry in the country has been adversely affected and sort of bailed out by the government. So why treat railways any different? But rail passenger numbers will return, the advertising will return, the retail will return, and so on. And you have to take a very, very long-term view of the railway. But also, you have to take a very, very long-term view of the planet as well. And whilst the planet is baking because of global warming, we have to find carbon-neutral ways of travelling and carrying freight, and rail is a very, very good way of doing that. Electric trains don't pollute, whereas, you know, cars do. The vast majority of cars are still burning petrol and will do for some time to come, and the government has to change that if it's to meet its obligations about reducing carbon outputs and saving the planet.
What does it say about the government's protestations in that regard? I mean, they do say that we are going to, at some point in the future, after which all of the current politicians will have retired to a comfortable future, so they won't be responsible when we get to 2040 or 2050, when they've suggested we meet net zero. So what does it say about their plan, their supposed plans, and yet their reluctance to keep rail travel at the sort of price levels that you see in other countries?
Well, indeed, we do have, you know, pretty much the most expensive fares in Europe, give or take a little. But, you know, there are some outrageous comparisons compared to France, Germany, Italy, whatever, Czech Republic. It's really cheap over there. But what it says, I mean, I think you're making the case for me, it says it's empty rhetoric, that the politicians can make these promises now and just ignore them, because by the time it comes to the crunch and these promises will have to be met, they'll be retired, and it's someone else's problem, not my problem, Gov. But, you know, don't we have a climate meeting coming up imminently? You know, it shows a sort of, you know, a lack of commitment to the climate cause when the government is encouraging people to take the car and discouraging people from taking environmentally friendly trains.
Yeah, there will be a point at which it becomes self-reinforcing, because the number of trains are being cut. I live in a place where the number of trains have been cut by half because there aren't enough people, or there's not as many as there used to be, travelling. And so when they cut the trains to match the current demand, then will the current demand keep going down because the number of trains is going down? And you can see, actually, that the level of service will be unsustainable.
Yeah, I think there is a real danger of that sort of vicious spiral downwards of services. So I think, you know, again, it comes back to my point about taking a long-term view about this. The government not losing their nerve when it comes to funding the railways in the short term, because, you know, COVID will pass, maybe we'll get over Brexit, and, you know, things will return more or less back to normal. And it's important that those rail services are sustained and continue to operate, so that when the good times roll back, those trains are back attracting passengers and taking cars off the road.
Is there something to be said for more spend in rural areas? Because London itself has had an enormous amount of money spent on it. The London Bridge Station is a wonder. Crossrail is will arrive eventually. But there's a lot of people in areas outside London that are poorly served by the trains.
Yeah, that's undoubtedly true, and it's a big argument that people in the north of England are putting at the moment. You know, I think London does get the lion's share of it, but I think what's really important is that we don't present this as a kind of either-or thing. You know, there's a very, very strong case for Crossrail and Crossrail 2. There's a very, very strong case for investing in railways in the north, what's known as Northern Powerhouse Rail or HS3. We need that. In the West Country, we need it further electrification. As far as Weston-super-Mare, Bath, maybe down to Exeter, you know, all of these areas have a very strong case in themselves, and it's very dangerous to sort of be in a position where they're fighting against each other. We as campaigners, we campaign for rail across the board. We want investment across the country.
What's your opinion of renationalisation? Because if everything got brought back under government control, then there would be fewer bodies operating for profit.
Yeah, I mean, the profit issue isn't really the problem, because the train operating companies have made very, very small margins. The issue really is the integration or fragmentation of the railways, and bringing Great British Railways into existence to sort of integrate the whole of the railways, I think, is a step in the right direction. But let's not forget that even under a privatised railway, it's still being basically run by the government. So actually, if and when things are nationalised, we wouldn't notice much change. In fact, to some extent, they have already, of course, because franchises don't exist anymore. But, you know, your average passenger didn't notice that. The government is now running the railways and contracting out fixed price contracts to the train operating companies, and the government is taking the revenue and the risk of running the railways. They're taking the ticket money, not the train operating companies.
Are there any other countries that you could point to as representing best practice?
I think there's no sort of single silver bullet on this. You know, this country, Great Britain, we have one of the safest railways in Europe. So we're doing best practice for safety. But you can look at other countries and look at certainly, you know, for costs, many, many other European countries do it better. For high-speed rail, the French are 40 years ahead of us. The Japanese are 50-something years ahead of us. So we've got a lot of catching up to do on high-speed rail. But it's kind of horses for courses, really. I think you cherry-pick the bits you want. But I think it is wise to learn from how other countries can do it better than us.
Good to talk to you. Thank you, Bruce. That's Cheers. Bruce Williamson from Rail Future, who campaign for improvements to the passenger and freight rail network. You're listening to LBC. Back to your calls about Afghanistan next.